Lord Peter Whimsey. Starring Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter, with Gabriel Wolfe as Inspector Parker. Unnatural Death by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted in 7 episodes by Chris Miller. Episode 5, The Property Act. Lord Peter Whimsey suspects Mary Whittaker of having murdered her great-aunt, Miss Agatha Dawson, in November 1925. Talking one afternoon with his friend, Inspector Parker, and his solicitor, Mr. Merbles, he suddenly realises that the new Property Act, which came into force in January 1926, might provide the perfect motive for the crime.
Good heavens, Lord Peter, I see what you mean.
Now, be calm, Merbles. Let's go through this thing once again to be absolutely sure that we've got it right. Now, Agatha Dawson died in November 1925 without leaving a will. And Mary Whittaker, as her only surviving relative, inherited everything under the old Property Act.
Quite so.
However, if Miss Dawson had lived until March 26, as her doctor fully expected her to do, the inheritance would have been governed by the new Act instead.
Yes, but my opinion is that as the deceased great-niece, she would probably still have been entitled to inherit.
But you are not absolutely positive.
No, I'm not. The matter hinges on the crucial point whether in the new Act the issue of the deceased brothers and sisters means nephews and nieces only, or, and this is the interpretation I incline towards, includes great-nephews, great-nieces, and so on ad infinitum.
Yes, but surely, Peter, the very ambiguity of the new Act provides sufficient motive for hastening the old girl's death.
Well, quite right, Charles, of course it does. If the great-niece inherits anyhow, Miss Dawson may as well die under the new Act as under the old. But if there was any doubt about it, well, tempting to give her a little push over the edge so as to make her die in 1925, what? Especially as she couldn't live long anyhow when there were no other relatives to be defrauded.
Yes, incidentally, suppose the great-niece is excluded from the inheritance, where does the money go?
It goes to the Duchy of Lancaster. Or, in other words, to the Crown.
In fact, to no one in particular. Well, upon my soul, I really can't see that it's very much of a crime to bump a poor old thing off a bit previously when she's suffering horribly, just to get the money she intends you to have anyway. It's only because she had such a silly superstitious aversion to making a will that the problem arose at all. Why the devil should the Duchy of Lancaster get the money? Who cares about the Duchy of Lancaster? It's like defrauding the income tax.
I think before we go any further, we ought to consult a specialist in this branch of the law to tell us precisely what the word issue does mean in this context.
Good idea, Merbles. Whom do you suggest?
Well, Tulkington of Gray's Inn is quite the ablest authority I could name. Greatly as I dislike that modern invention, the telephone, I think it might be advisable to ring him up and ascertain whether he can give us the benefit of his opinion after dinner this evening.
After dinner?
Yes, Lord Peter. Tulkington, you see, has some very excellent port.
Mud in your eye, gentlemen.
Bottoms up.
Cheerio.
Cheerio. Well, now, Merbles, I've been going into this little matter since you rang this afternoon. Awkward, eh? Yeah, it's an astonishing thing that people can't say what they mean when they draw up acts, eh? Now, why do you suppose it is, Lord Peter, eh? Come now.
Well, I suspect it's because acts are drawn up by lawyers.
To make work for themselves, eh? I dare say you're right. Even lawyers must live, eh? Very good. The question here turns on the interpretation of the word issue. You seem to think it means issue ad infinitum. How do you make that out? Come now.
I didn't say I thought it did. I said I thought it might. The general intention of the act...
Intention? Oh, I'm astonished at you, Merbles. The law has nothing to do with good intentions. What does the Act say? It says, to the brothers and sisters of the whole blood and their issue. And now, in the absence of any new definition, I should say that the word issue is to be construed here as it was construed on intestacy before the act.
Yes.
Then I don't see that you and your great niece have a leg to stand on, come now, eh? more port, Inspector.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Tarkington, but do you mind? I know lay people are awful ignorant nuisances, but if you would be so good as to explain what the beastly word did or does mean, it would be uncommonly helpful, don't you know?
Well, it's like this. More port.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, let me try to be as clear as possible, Lord Peter. If someone dies without making a will...
Intestate, yes, I know.
Quite so. Mervyn's, no?
Thank you.
Yes, I thought you would. Well, now, if someone dies intestate, leaving no spouse, the property goes equally to the children of the deceased and their issue. And in this case, issue has always meant issue ad infinitum. However, if the succession is to a branch of the family, issue of any person only means the child of that person and does not include other descendants. Come now. Your Miss Whittaker is not Miss Dawson's daughter. She is not even her granddaughter. All she is the daughter of the son of Miss Dawson's sister. Accordingly, I think she is debarred from inheriting under the new act, eh, huh?
Yes, I see your point. So she had a pretty good motive for murder.
Providing she knew about the new act and its consequences as early as October 1925, yes.
Well, there's no reason why she shouldn't. I remember reading an article in the Evening Banner, I think it was, some months earlier, about the time the act was having its second reading. Mary Whittaker may easily have seen it, too.
Well, she'd probably have taken advice about it if she did. Who is her usual man of affairs?
A man called Probyn, but I don't think she'd have asked him, Mervyn. Not if she were wise, that is. I expect she went to some stranger and asked a few innocent little questions under another name.
Probably, Lord Peter.
But you don't think Mr. Probyn mentioned the matter to her the time he went down to Leehampton and tried to get Miss Dawson to make a will?
No, Charles, I don't. But I'm pretty certain he tried to explain matters to the old lady. Mm. Only she was so terrified of the very idea of a will, she wouldn't let him get a word in. Anyway, you can easily find out. Probyn's in Italy. He's retired. I was going to write to him, Mervyn, but perhaps you'd better do it. In the meanwhile, Charles and I will think up a way to find whoever it was that did give Miss Whittaker an opinion on the matter. A tour of solicitors seems indicated, Charles.
You're not forgetting, I suppose, that before pinning down a murder to any particular motive, it is usual to ascertain that a murder has been committed. So far, all we know is that after a careful post-mortem analysis, two qualified doctors have agreed that Miss Dawson died a natural death.
I wish you wouldn't keep on saying the same thing, Charles. It does bore me so. It's like the raven never flittin', which, as the poet observes, still is sittin'. Inviting one to heave a pallid bust of Pallas at him and have done with it. You've never believed in this murder, have you?
Well, I'm coming round to it now, Peter. I don't deny you've got a motive at last, but I do wish you could provide a method to...
Oh, I'll find you one, never fear. You wait till I publish my epoch-making work, The Murderer's Vade Mecum, or 101 Ways of Causing Sudden Death. It's bound to be in there somewhere. And that, I sincerely hope, Charles, will show you that I am not a man to be trifled with. Charles? Parker!
Whimsy! No, it's all right, I'll come over. Oh, Peter, I've just been down to your flat. Bunter said you were lunching at your club.
Quite correct, old bean. And I've got something exciting to tell you, too. Mervyn's has had a reply from Probyn. Walk down to St. James's with me and I'll tell you about it.
Well, I've got a lot to do this afternoon, Peter.
Well, of course you have. Beastly unfair, ain't it, the way when we work on a case together, I make the imbecile suggestions and you have to do all the lengthy, tedious and soul-destroying work following them up?
It is, yes.
Well, I suppose for the past week you've been calling on solicitors, have you?
I have, actually.
Any luck?
No, not yet, but...
Look, let me tell you about Probyn, then. We were quite right, you know, Charles.
Right?
About his having mentioned the new property act to the old lady. He did try to get her to make a will. No success, of course. But he didn't let on to Mary Whittaker.
Oh, he didn't?
Oh, no. No, too canny for that, our probing.
Oh, well. Perhaps she read about it in the papers, as you suggested, then. And I still haven't been able to track down anyone who did give her advice on the subject. I talked to all the solicitors in Leehampton. She'd been to see none of them.
Well, of course she hadn't. I know where she went for legal counsel, and it certainly wasn't Leehampton.
You do? Well, for God's sake, Peter, why didn't you say so before?
To the person who has anything to conceal, Charles, there is one name above others which promises a haven of safety and oblivion. London.
Even I deduced that much.
London, where no one knows his neighbour, where shops don't even know their customers, where physicians are suddenly called to unknown patients whom they never see again, where strangers are friendly and friends are casual, discreet, incurious, and all-enfolding London.
Thank you. I have narrowed it down to Bloomsbury, possibly Holborn.
Oh? How did you manage to do that, Charles?
She trained at the Royal Free Hospital. Londoners hardly ever move out of their own particular little orbit.
Very true. But what an area do we have to search? Gray's Inn, Gray's Inn Road, Bedford Row. The place absolutely swarms with solicitors.
Ah, the brass plates are as thick as blackberries. I'd better be getting along, Peter. You wouldn't like to come and share the chore, I don't suppose?
No, I'm sorry, old Sam, but I'm meeting Freddy Arbuthnot at Laws to watch the New Zealanders. Must harden, in fact. Taxi! Taxi! Lord's driver. Toodaloo, Charles.
Bye. Oh, by the way, Peter, when I was in Leehampton, I called on Miss Clemson, and she said that
you'll
I...
Tell me later!
Damn, Quincy. Lord's, indeed. Lord's? Amateur. Oh, well. Back to the solicitors.
Mr. Parker, good afternoon.
So sorry to keep you waiting.
Not at all.
Do come in, won't you? Please sit down.
Thank you.
Now, what can I do for you?
Well, the thing is, Mr. Trigg, my wife and I have come up to town today to see her great aunt, who's in a very bad way. In fact, she isn't expected to live, and as a result, we... find we need some legal advice.
Uh-huh. Well, do go on.
Well, the point is, the old lady's always been very fond of my wife, don't you see? And it's always been an understood thing that Mrs. Parker was to come into her money when she died. There aren't any other relations, so we've never worried very much whether she'd ever made a will. But we were talking to a friend yesterday, and he said there was a new law or something, so... I wondered if you could tell me, how does a great-niece stand under the new arrangements?
Well, the point has not been made very clear, but my advice to you is to find out whether a will has been made, and if not, to get one made without delay, if the testatrix is capable of making one. Otherwise, I think there's a very real danger of your wife's losing her inheritance.
You seem quite familiar with the question. I suppose you're always being asked it since this new act came in?
I wouldn't say always. It's comparatively rare for a great-niece to be left as sole next of kin, you know.
Is it? Mm. Well, yes, I should think it must be. But can you tell me, Mr. Trigg, do you remember being asked that question in the summer of 1925?
Eh? What makes you ask that?
Now, you need have no hesitation in answering. I'm a police officer, and I'm making certain inquiries.
I see. Well, Inspector, in that case, I suppose I am justified in telling you all about it. I was asked that question in June 1925.
Hmm. Now, do you remember the circumstances?
Clearly. I'm not likely to forget them. Or, rather, the sequel to them.
Well, that sounds interesting.
I think you may find it so. Allow me a moment to marshal my thoughts. Won't you smoke?
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Now, I think it was on the 15th or 16th of June 1925 mm-hmm. that a lady called to ask almost exactly the same question that you have done. Only she said she was inquiring on behalf of a friend whose name she did not mention. She gave her own name as Miss Grant, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I gave her the same opinion that I gave you just now, and she looked rather concerned about it. In fact, almost more annoyed than concerned. It seems rather unfair, she said, that people's family money should go away to the Crown like that. After all, a great-niece is quite a near relation, really. I replied that I didn't know that the great-niece would be excluded under the Act, only that I thought she might be. And that, anyway, there were still 6 months before the Act came into force, and many things might happen before then. Yes, indeed, said Miss Grant. You mean that Auntie may die...
Auntie?
Yes. The friend's great-aunt had suddenly become Auntie. I dare say my client felt a more personal interest in the matter than she cared to admit.
I dare say she did.
Anyway, Inspector, she paid my fee, and as she rose to go, offered me her hand. In taking it, I happened to notice rather an odd scar running across the backs of all the fingers, rather as though a chisel or something had slipped at some time.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Yes. Anyway, I didn't expect to see Miss Grant again. However, the following December, I ran across her in a Soho restaurant. It was crowded, and we were forced to share a table. And by way of starting a conversation, I asked her whether the great-aunt had ever made a will. She replied that it had not been necessary, as the old lady had since died. I noticed that Miss Grant herself was dressed in black, and was thus confirmed in my opinion that she was the great-niece concerned.
That's pretty conclusive, I'd say.
I think so. Now, mark the sequel, if that's what it was. About 6 weeks later, just before 11 on the evening of January the 26th, to be exact, I was about to go to bed when the telephone rang. I answered it, and a woman's voice spoke, begging me to come instantly to a certain house on Hampstead Heath to make a will for someone at the point of death.
Did you recognize the voice?
No, it had a strong Cockney accent. Anyway, though rather annoyed at being disturbed so late, I went out and was lucky enough to find a taxi on the nearest rank. I live at Golders Green, by the way, not far from the Heath.
Did Miss Grant know that?
I think I had told her, yes. We drove to the address, which, incidentally, we had great difficulty in finding, because there was no proper approach to it. Eventually, however, I left the taxi on the road about a couple of hundred yards off, and asked the man to wait for me, saying I wouldn't be long. I made my way to the house. At first I thought it was quite dark, but presently I saw a faint glimmer in a ground-floor room. I rang the bell. No answer. I rang again and knocked. Still no answer. It was bitterly cold. I struck a match to be sure I'd come to the right house, and then I noticed that the front door was ajar. Hello? Anyone there? Hello?
Oh.
Are you all right? Hello? Where are you? Hello? Hello. You there? May I come in?
Yes, please.
Are you all right? It's very dark.
No light, please. It hurts me.
It doesn't work, anyway.
No, the candle's enough. Is that the lawyer?
Yes. What can I do for you?
Please sit down. By the bed. Please. Yes. I've had a terrible accident. I can't live. No, please sit down. Thank you. I want to make my will quickly. Have you got a form?
Yes, I have, but are you all right? Is there no one with you?
My maid. She'll be back in a moment. She's gone to look for a doctor.
Look for one? Well, couldn't she have rung up? You're too ill to be left alone.
We couldn't get through. It's all right. She'll be back soon. Please, let's not waste time. I must make my will.
Very well.
Could I have a little brandy? There.
Of course.
Thank you. And do have one yourself. A large one.
Thank you. I will. It's beastly cold in here. Haven't you any more coal for the fire?
No. My maid will fetch some when she returns. I'm sorry. You may think I'm a little mad because my head has been so hurt, but I'm quite sane. And he shan't have a penny of the money.
Who? Has someone attacked you?
My husband. He thinks he's killed me. But I'm going to live long enough to will all my money away. Yes. Are you ready to begin? Please. Have some more brandy if you're cold.
Thank you. Right then. If you're sure you're all right, you'd better start by giving me your full name.
My name is Marion Angelica Mead. Mrs. Mead. I'm worth approximately £10,000. I wish to leave it all to my daughter and my three sisters. Please help me. I want to be sure that the money I leave to my daughter can never be handed over to her father. What should I do?
The best thing would be to tie it up in a trust.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. My daughter is only 11. Are you all right?
Yes. It's just a little sleepy. Sorry, I do apologize. Now, how much do you wish to leave to your daughter?
Oh, dear.
I am so sorry. I don't know why I suddenly feel so sleepy. I'm sorry. Now, Mrs. Mead, can you give me, please, the full names and addresses of the four legatees?
Yes. My daughter is Mary Victoria Mead, and she lives, or rather, she will live when I'm gone, with her Aunt Vera. Are you sure you're all right?
Yes, I think so. Look, one moment, Mrs. Mead. Where is your servant?
What do you want her for?
Well, we shall need another witness to make this will legal. Once I've made it out, that is.
She'll be here by then.
Are you sure?
Oh, yes. She should be back any moment. I can't think what's happened to her.
Well, look, anyway, I'm feeling terribly dopey all of a sudden. I need some fresh air. I'll go and get my taxi man. He'll do as a witness.
No! Don't do that. Don't leave me. Wait a minute, please. My maid won't be long.
I must get outside. I feel... God, I feel...
Yes?
What do you mean, S, like that? I don't...
Who's that?
Governor? You there, Governor?
Here.
Yeah, Governor, I thought you said...
Hello?
What's going on?
Driver, we'd like you to witness...
Oh, blimey. Here, Governor, what's the game? Here, ladies, has he had too much?
Yes.
Oh, blimey. Well, I think I'd better get him home. Oh, this is a rum start, right enough. Oh, come on then, Governor. Up we get. Up, said Daisy now. Now, come along.
And that, Inspector, is all I remember of that evening. The taxi driver took me home, dug my visiting card and my latchkey out of my pocket, got me upstairs somehow, and then, deciding that if I was drunk, I was a worse drunk than he'd ever encountered in his experience, humanely fetched a doctor for me.
He'd been drugged?
Yes, veronal. Fortunately, if the idea was to murder me, the dose had been very much underestimated.
Yeah. And, Mrs. Mead?
Never heard of again. We went round to the house the next day, and there was no sign of her, as I needn't tell you. The house was shut up, and the local milkman informed us that the occupiers had been away for a week and weren't expected home for another 10 days. When they did come back, they weren't keen to start expensive inquiries. After all, they'd lost nothing but a shilling's worth of coals. And seeing that I hadn't actually been murdered, I thought it best to let the matter slide, too.
Well, that's all very interesting, Mr. Trick. But what made you think that your adventure on Hampstead Heath had anything to do with Miss Grant?
Ah, I'm sorry, Inspector. Silly of me. Just as the taxi man was picking me up, I came to again, momentarily. Mrs. Mead had turned over a little in bed, and to support herself had put both her hands on the edge of the bedside table. In that instant, I noticed two things. One, that she wasn't wearing a wedding ring. And two, that across the back of the fingers of the right hand was a curious scar. The sort of scar that could have been caused by something slipping, something like a chisel.
Very interesting, Charles. A word to Miss Clemson is indicated, I think, just to find out whether Miss Mary Whittaker does have a scar on her right hand. I need hardly say that I'm sure she has.
Oh, no, no.
Well, even you must admit that this has the makings of a case now, what?
Well, yes.
Oh, Charles, don't be so confoundedly cautious. You will not, I imagine, deny that very odd things seem to happen to people who know that Mary Whittaker tried desperately hard to get her aunt, her great-aunt, I should say, to make a will.
To Mr. Triggs, certainly.
Oh, really? Look, what about the others? What about Nurse Philitter, forced to leave after Mary's attempt to trick Miss Dawson into will-making? What about the go-to-bed sisters, sacked for the same reason? What about the go-to-bed sisters, Parker? Bertha is later found dead in Epping Forest under suspicious circumstances, and Evelyn thinks she spots Mary Whittaker lying in wait for her at Liverpool Docks.
Wait a minute, Peter. That couldn't have been Mary Whittaker.
Now, what do you mean?
No, I know we'd rather assumed it was, but Mary wasn't anywhere near Liverpool the day Evelyn arrived from Canada.
Well, how can you be so sure?
Miss Clemson. Miss Clemson's had a long talk with Vera Findlater, Mary's friend. She and Mary were in Kent all last month. They never left each other's side. Vera Findlater, Peter, gives Mary Whittaker a cast-iron alibi.
In that episode of Unnatural Death, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael. Inspector Parker, Gabriel Wolfe. Mrs. Mead, Marianne Saint-Val. Mr. Merbles, Malcolm Hayes. Mr. Tarkington, Gerard Green. Mr. Trigg, Gordon Clyde. The Property Act was adapted by Chris Miller from the book Unnatural Death by Dorothy L. Sayers. The programme was produced by Simon Brett.